Good morning to everybody. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I'm Lynn Curry, and I am a member of Prairie that comes up here every once in a while to help guide things. Prairie aspires to be an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, gender, or family structure. We welcome you no matter what your age is or your abilities or inabilities. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services. We're happy today to welcome Johanna Hatch, one of our members, back up to present to us. Sometimes we also hear from members of the wider community or Sandy Ingham, our consulting minister. Today, of course, we'll be hearing from Johanna. Our opening words today are going to be shared by Barb Park. Thank you, Barb.
I do not believe that just because you're opposed to abortion, that makes you pro-life. In fact, I think in many cases, your morality is deeply lacking if all you want is a child born, but not a child fed, not a child educated, not a child housed. And why would I think that you don't? Because you don't want any tax money to go there. That's not pro-life, that's pro-birth. We need a much broader conversation on what the morality of pro-life is. That's by Sister Simone Campbell from the Nuns on the Bus.
Now I welcome Johanna up. She's here, there she is, to talk with us about women and personhood. So thank you, Johanna.
So today I want to talk a bit about the idea of women as persons or women as people. This is really a way that I kind of approach a lot of discussions about reproductive rights, about feminism. And I know at our Prairie retreat there was a wonderful session kind of about the history of abortion rights in the United States, and I was kind of chatting with the folks there. I started kind of like going off on my rant about, you know, like, well, women are people, and like, that's really the problem, is that we don't treat women like they're people. That's where this all comes from. And somebody was like, oh, you should talk about this at Prairie. So I was like, so that's why I'm here today, to talk a little bit about this. And I think since I've talked to you folks last, I'm now officially an RN. I'm a registered nurse. So this also is just a little bit informed kind of about by the work that I'm doing right now. Let's start with the first principle we have up on the wall over there. We believe in the inherent dignity and worth, or the inherent worth and dignity of every person. And for me, I think that's really foundational for us as Unitarian Universalists. And I've really seen, you know, it both like in our community, how this really is the foundation of how we interact with each other, and I think how we interact with the world at large. So that was really my starting point in thinking about today's topic. And like I said, the question I'm going to focus on today is the question of, are women persons? Are women persons worthy of being treated with inherent worth and dignity, legally and ethically? And you know, I know that this is a rhetorical question, and I'm assuming I don't have to convince anybody here, I hope, of this very basic idea that women are people. But you know, as we look, there's a few international cases I'm going to highlight, a couple legal trends in the United States that really make me need to pose that question. You know, there are these trends and these laws that really are seeking to deny women their very basic rights to bodily autonomy and self-determination. So this is a question that I'm going to invite you to reflect on as I'm speaking today. And so we have to start with, you know, our basic definitions. What is a person? And this is not as simple a question as you would think, as I learned recently doing a Google search with that very question. There's a lot of philosophical discussions. There's a lot of different definitions in law, in philosophy, in religion, in ethics. So kind of like the starting point that I'm going to be working from, the definitions I'm going to be using, is that we can say that a person is a human being. And we know that this concept of personhood varies across cultures, across religions. It causes huge debates legally and ethically. So then the best definition I could find, kind of building on if we're starting with a human being, is that a person is an entity that has the moral right to self-determination. And the right of women to that self-determination is really the center of everything I'm going to be talking about moving forward. And so the question, if we believe that every person has inherent worth and dignity, what gives a person that worth and dignity? Our Unitarian Universalist tradition affirms that worth and dignity are inherent. It cannot be granted by an external authority, nor can it be taken away. It is simply the condition of our humanity. People do not lose their rights to life or liberty, nor do they lose their right to moral self-determination due to any transient state. So if this is the case, then when we assert that women are persons, their dignity and worth and the worth of their lives and well-being cannot be dependent on whether or not they are pregnant. However, we live in a culture that still systematically devalues women, and the unique ability of women to become pregnant is often used as a justification to deny women of their basic rights. And when we talk about personhood in our current context, a lot of the discussion in recent years has really been centered around the idea of applying legal personhood to embryos and fetuses. There is a movement that has been growing in the United States for some time under the banner of an organization called Personhood USA, which is a national organization that seeks to enshrine fetal personhood into law. They boast on their website that since 2008, legislation supporting the legal definition of fetal personhood to include constitutional rights has been introduced in 35 states. They did not mention how many states it passed in, though. I noticed that. While leaders of this movement really try to deny and kind of distance themselves from the idea of a future where women are denied really basic rights to civil liberties as well as their own lives and well-being if they experience a doomed pregnancy, we can really, we have case studies essentially from other countries that have such laws in place, and we can really see exactly what that future would be like for women in the United States if those kinds of laws were passed. Two stories I'm going to highlight today are from the countries of Ireland and El Salvador, where abortion is criminalized and fetuses have the same legal rights and status as born people. So I'm going to present these case studies of sorts to try to highlight the reality that when women lose their legal personhood, and when fetal life, even doomed fetal life, is given equal or greater legal rights than women, the women who bear it, there are really, really dire consequences that kind of lead to that question again, are women people in these cases? So the first story, and I'm sure many of you might have been familiar with this, happened in 2013, the case of Savita Halappanavar, who is an Indian woman living in Ireland. Her case came to international fame very quickly after she died in a hospital in Galway in 2013. She was 17 weeks pregnant, and her body began to miscarry. And due to that, the beginning of the miscarriage, Savita developed an infection that would ultimately lead to her death. When it was clear that the pregnancy was contributing to her rapid decline, both she and her husband begged their care providers for an abortion to end the pregnancy. And the response that she received was that because of Ireland's strict abortion laws, and there is still a fetal heartbeat present, her doctors could do nothing to help her. Her husband later told news outlets that when a midwife actually told her that they couldn't do anything because this is Ireland and Ireland was a Catholic country, her response was, "Well, I'm not Irish or Catholic." And I think that's really, really highlights the cruel fate that women face, you know, that simply by virtue of where you happen to be, you can lose your right to bodily autonomy, you can lose your right to adequate health care, life-saving treatment, you lose the right to really, you know, determine your values around your religion, around your medical care. All those things can be imposed upon you. And it's also now as a healthcare provider, it's even more unconscionable to me. You know, did her healthcare providers really believe that she was a person of dignity and worth? Did the Republic of Ireland care at all about her moral self-determination? Was Savita treated as a person in this case? And another case that has kind of come to notoriety in recent years is the case of, and I apologize because I don't speak Spanish, so I'm going to call them the 17 of El Salvador. So in 1998, after many, many years of the brutal civil war in El Salvador, when the country finally came together, they enacted some really, really strict abortion laws, some of the strictest laws in the world, with great support from the Catholic Church in the country. Their laws criminalize all abortions, even when a woman's life is in danger, or in cases of severe fetal abnormalities or sexual assault. Between 1999 and 2011, at least 129 women have been charged with what they call abortion-related crimes. 17 of these women were following a reported miscarriage when they presented at the hospital seeking help, fearful that they were losing their pregnancies. A typical charge for a woman with an abortion-related charge is aggravated homicide, which carries a charge of 30 to 40 years in prison, including those 17 women who were seeking medical care when they were fearful that they were losing their pregnancy. And according to Amnesty International, as of March of this year, there are at least 5 more women in El Salvador facing these charges. And I think this case, these cases of these women in El Salvador really illustrate that when fetal personhood is legally viewed as the equivalent to the personhood of a woman, women bear the burden of losing their legal rights and their legal personhood. Even when through no fault of their own, they can't, their bodies will not sustain fetal life. So, and it was just this spring, in February, after many, many years of advocacy, including appeals for a presidential pardon, only one of the 17 has been released from prison after serving nearly 10 years of her sentence for aggravated homicide. Her name is Carmen Guadalupe Vasquez. She is now a free woman. Her story is particularly tragic because she was the victim of a sexual assault and became pregnant. And when she was fearful that she was losing her pregnancy, she sought help at an emergency room. And instead of being treated adequately, she was greeted by the police and then sentenced to 30 years in jail. And the other 16 women of this group remain behind bars in El Salvador. And I think it's really kind of tempting to think like, oh, like this is a problem outside of, you know, our immediate lives here in the United States in 2015. But I know right before I kind of sent Penny, you know, my ideas for this talk, Wisconsin's legislature passed a bill banning abortions past 20 weeks of pregnancy. Actually, the way the bill is worded is 20 weeks post-conception, which is not really a way that anybody dates pregnancies. So it's creating some legal confusion. And it was very, very quickly signed into law by Governor Scott Walker, immediately prior to announcing his run for the Republican nomination for president. And this law is set to go into effect next February 1st, February 2016, and it will punish any doctor that performs such a procedure. I believe the punishment includes $10,000 in fines, and I'm not sure how much time in prison. And I think, I mean, so we're thinking about abortions at 20 weeks of pregnancy, and it can be something that's really, really hard to think about, especially for those of us who are parents or women who have carried pregnancies to term. But I do want to highlight that these cases account for about 1% of all abortions that happen in Wisconsin. And to give you a number, that's less than 100 per year. And for people that, you know, have carried a pregnancy to term, I think you know that around 20 weeks is usually when you get the anatomy scan and you get to, you know, see that everything is in place. And that's often when people get really devastating news about things that are not developing properly, or a pregnancy that is not going to be a baby that's not going to live outside the womb for very long. And then also for women who are really facing grave health risks, because after 20 weeks of pregnancy is when we see preeclampsia start to develop, if it's going to develop. And sometimes, you know, it happens way before that fetus can be viable. And, you know, the only way to save someone with preeclampsia is to end a pregnancy one way or the other. And so What I think is really interesting with this case as well is when the governor signed this bill into law, he actually had a disagreement with this law. He didn't like that there actually is an exemption for the life of the mother. A woman who is facing preeclampsia and, 20, 21 weeks of pregnancy, hopefully could find a doctor who would be able to help her. But then in last week's Republican presidential candidate debate, he was asked about his position, that there should not be an exemption for the life of a pregnant woman. And he was asked, are you too far outside the mainstream? Because 83% of Americans believe that there should always be an exemption for a woman's life to end a pregnancy. And his response was that he was very confident that he was not outside the mainstream. His quote, and I just copied the quote in entirety, because I thought it was really interesting and I thought it was really illustrative. He said, quote, "I have always been pro-life. I've got a position that's consistent with many Americans out there in that I believe that that is an unborn child that's in need of protection out there. And I've said many times that that unborn child can be protected and there are many alternatives that would protect the life of the mother." And I highlight this because I think it's really interesting that only at the end of his response did he even mention the person whose life was potentially in danger carrying this pregnancy. And it's really as an afterthought. And so this woman as afterthought, when we're talking about pregnancy and we're talking about laws around pregnancy, is such a clear illustration of how the full personhood of women is really still questionable in the United States in 2015. And kind of bringing this topic up, like I said, it's not that I'm disturbed by the impulse to protect a pregnancy. And I understand that really, as we talk about later and later abortions or ending pregnancies at later stages, a lot of people who would personally identify as pro-choice start to feel like, this is getting messy and questionable. But I want to bring it back to that illustration that the woman was the afterthought. That this kind of casual disregard for women's lives is just so easily tossed out there. When really, I feel like this entire conversation has to be centered around women. Because it is the woman who we can look at her, there should be no debate. A woman is a person. A woman's life has value and dignity and worth. And so then I also kind of wanted to bring this to kind of refocus it on another spot. I want to have just a brief word about birth. So most of you folks know that prior to becoming a nurse, I worked as a doula and childbirth educator. And one other trend in the United States is that these laws that really are focused on privileging fetal life, or case law that justifies the arrest of women or incarcerating women who are pregnant because the choices they make about their pregnancy are not acceptable to the state, is a huge impact of these laws, not just on women who choose to end a pregnancy, but on women who choose to give birth. There's an organization called the National Advocates for Pregnant Women, which is dedicated to ensuring the constitutional rights and well-being of women. It was founded, they did a study recently and they found between 1973, which is when Roe versus Wade became the law of the land allowing abortion in the United States, and 2005, there were over 400 cases in the United States in which, they described it, in which a woman's pregnancy was a necessary factor leading to attempted and actual deprivations of women's physical liberty. These cases include instances where women were forcibly removed from their homes while in labor, handcuffed, taken to a hospital, and forced to undergo a cesarean against their will. And lest you think that, it only went to 2005, so hopefully it's not a problem anymore, in 2013, National Advocates for Pregnant Women took on the case of a woman who also was refusing a cesarean and then received an email from her OBGYN threatening her with arrest, saying, "We will send the police to your home if you do not come in for your scheduled surgery." And so I know that it can be really, really tempting when we're talking about these questions of fetal personhood or questions of abortion to try to separate, the women who give birth from the women who choose to end a pregnancy. But we know that the reality is that these are most often the same women at different points in their lives. the majority of women who have an abortion already have children at home that they are thinking about when they make that decision. So the ability to deprive one woman of her worth and dignity simply for being pregnant really threatens the well-being of all women, regardless of the choices that they make around their pregnancies. And like I think I kind of alluded to earlier, the question for me really remains less about debating about fetal personhood, but really reshaping our conversation to elevate the personhood of women. If women's rights and bodily autonomy and medical decision-making were firmly enshrined in law, and if women were actually viewed as capable moral agents, I believe that this debate, there would be very little debate. There would absolutely still be debate, because there are folks that I know don't really, are really kind of against that, who don't believe that women have the moral capacity to make decisions about their pregnancies. I believe that, I believe that a lot of these debates around fetal personhood are actually less about the rights of fetuses and than they are about our cultural beliefs about women, our cultural beliefs around sex and our beliefs about motherhood. A lot of these, we still have these cultural notions that good women don't have sex or they don't like sex or they certainly don't have it for any other reason than procreation. We believe that good women are selfless. We believe that kind of culturally we still have this belief that sex is bad and punishment is deserved if you transgress that. And we also have a really strong belief about motherhood being like kind of the pinnacle of womanhood in our culture. And women who reject that or who don't believe that that's the best choice for them are seen as somehow deficient or broken or even not really capable of making that decision for themselves. I mean, often circles of reproductive rights and bodily autonomy, you often hear stories of women who desperately want a tubal ligation so that they never have to worry about getting pregnant. And doctors consistently reject them if they have no children. Oh, you're going to change your mind. Someday you're going to want a baby. So it's a double bind. You know, women can't make a decision to end a pregnancy without being judged. Women can't make a decision about the course of her pregnancy without being judged. A woman can't make a decision to actively prevent pregnancy when she knows that she does not want to be a mother without being told that she doesn't know what's best for herself and for her life. So kind of on the flip side, if we really believe that women truly are persons of dignity and worth, then abortion rights matter. And I think we have to say that. Abortion rights matter because women must be able to determine the course of their lives and health. And we are endowed, legally and ethically, with the right to consent or decline any recommended medical treatment for any reason. We have the right to control what happens within the confines of our bodies. And I know this is maybe a charged word for this group, but this is my belief. I believe this is sacred. I believe that we need to stop apologizing and proactively demand legal recognition of our personhood when forces rise that seek to diminish it. And in closing, I'm a longer quote, but Katha Pollitt, who I'm sure many of you are familiar with, the wonderful feminist essayist, in the New York Times earlier this week wrote a great piece called How to Really Defend Planned Parenthood. There's a lot of brouhaha going on around Planned Parenthood's work, as there always is. And I just lifted these couple sentences because I think it just perfectly summarizes exactly what I wanted to say today. And she wrote, "To deflect immediate attacks, we fall in with messaging that unconsciously encodes the vision of the other side. Abortion opponents say women seek abortions in haste and confusion. Pro-choicers reply, abortion is the most difficult, agonizing decision a woman ever makes. Opponents say women have abortions because they have irresponsible sex. We say rape, incest, fatal fetal abnormalities, life-risking pregnancies. These responses aren't false exactly. Some women are genuinely ambivalent. Some pregnancies are particularly dangerous. But they leave out the large majority of women seeking abortions who had sex willingly, made a decision to end the pregnancy, and faced no special threatening medical condition. We need to say that women have sex, have abortions, are at peace with the decision, and move on with their lives. We need to say that is their right, and moreover, it is good for everyone that they have this right, that the whole society benefits when motherhood is voluntary. When we gloss over these truths, we unintentionally promote the very stigma we're trying to combat. What, you didn't agonize? You forgot your pill? You just didn't want to have a baby right now? You should be ashamed of yourself. And I think that really, I mean, like I said, it just so perfectly captured what I wanted to say today, that we should really stop putting ourselves on the defensive and be proactively talking about the value and the worth and dignity of women as people. I believe that is the way to really hopefully change this conversation. And so I intentionally kept it shorter than usual because I know every other time I've spoken, there was never enough time for comments. So I'll leave it at that for now. And if I could just respond, because I'm kind of thinking with both of those too, I think, and this is just like, you know, for me, from kind of how I think about these issues is, you know, when we think about women and we think about pregnancy, there is no other time in the human condition where a person is forced to sustain the life of another person against their will. There's no other part of humanity where you are forced to use your body against your will to sustain the life of someone else. I mean, even like if you want to say like there, you know, we do not force women to breastfeed after they give birth because they have the right to decide, you know, this is not how I want to use my body to sustain the life of another person. And so the kind of the condition of having a female body and being able to become pregnant, I think, is really unique. And, you know, there's that opportunity, I think, to say, you know, like, limitations on self-determination, and perhaps if there's that argument about fetal personhood, you know, if you could, like Scott Walker talking about, like, there's a child out there somewhere, you know, if we could sustain a pregnancy somewhere out there, I think it would also be a different conversation. I think there's a lot of women who would be like, then, you know, take it, you know. And I'm sure there's more to develop about that, but that's just my initial kind of thoughts. Yeah, and I think that really gives, like, you know, this whole question of, are women people? Do women have the right to determine whether or not they even become pregnant? And so making it more difficult for women to access birth control, claiming that corporations have more right to not allow women to access contraception than an individual woman has to make a medical choice. And I think that it's kind of like this idea that, you know, where I say, is a woman a person? Is a woman considered a person that can make that decision without the interference of a third party? And I just wanted to highlight the case that Kent is talking about, if folks aren't familiar with it. The state of Colorado did a pilot program where they offered free IUDs to, I think, teenagers and young women under a certain level of the poverty line, and saw their unplanned pregnancy rate drop 40% within a year. Access to contraception prevents abortion. It's undeniable.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Now we'll welcome up Kate Liu and Karen Deaton for our closing words.
Women do not have to sacrifice personhood if they are mothers. They do not have to sacrifice motherhood in order to be persons. Liberation was meant to expand women's opportunities, not to limit them. The self-esteem that has been found in new pursuits can also be found in mothering.
Do you have any idea what year it is? Did you fall down, hit your head, and think you woke up in the 1950s or the 1890s? Should we call for a doctor? Because I simply cannot believe that in the year 2015, the United States Senate would be spending its time trying to defund women's health care centers. That was Elizabeth Warren in a Senate debate on defunding Planned Parenthood.
Thanks to everybody for coming today. Please extend the hand of friendship, hang out for coffee and conversations, and enjoy the day.